From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from conception to birth, new images of the fetus developing inside the womb. They allow us to see the development of the eyes, the brain, the vertebrae, everything. We'll talk with Alexander Tsiaras about how he creates these visualizations using the latest medical scanning technology as well as software programs that he helped create. There's a new book of his pictures. They're also on display at the National Museum of Health and Medicine. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a work of historical fiction called The Time of Our Singing by Richard Powers. It's a retelling of race relations in the 20th century. She says it's nothing if not audacious. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The mayor of Kinston, North Carolina, says at least two people have been killed and six are unaccounted for after a massive explosion and fire at a factory. A number of injured people have been taken to area hospitals, some of them in critical condition. Ike Sutherland is principal at a nearby school. He says the blast at the West Pharmaceutical plant was heard and felt a long way away.
It sounded like thunder magnified 10 times. It was just a huge thud. And I've never heard a major explosion, but it was definitely an explosion. You could tell that. It shook our buildings and all of our windows.
Emergency officials are asking people within a mile of the factory to evacuate because of smoke and plastic fumes from the wreckage. The factory made plastic medical devices such as parts for syringes and IV supplies. It was cited for safety violations last fall. President Bush traveled to Grand Rapids, Michigan today, where he continued to call on the world to take a hard line against Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president went on the road on the day following his State of the Union address to repeat the major themes of that speech. The event in West Michigan was officially one to push his proposals for Medicare reform and to call for limits on medical liability awards. But again, the dominant topic was Iraq, and the president continued to prepare the country for a possible war.
We're having an honest debate in this country, and we should, about peace and how to achieve the peace. Should be clear to you now, though, that in my judgment, you don't contain Saddam Hussein. You don't hope that therapy will somehow change his evil mind.
The president also said he wants the United Nations to be more than just a debating society. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
A group of Iraqi dissidents arrived in Hungary today for training in helping to change the regime in Baghdad after a possible attack on Iraq. Drew Leifheit reports from Budapest.
Following the arrival of their American trainers, 58 Iraqi volunteers have arrived at Hungary's Tosar Air Base south of the Hungarian capital. Hungary agreed last December to allow the U.S. to train around 3,000 Iraqis in military communication skills and small arms use. The trainees could assist an interim administration in the case of a regime change in Iraq. But according to a new poll here, 50% of Hungarians fear their country could become a terrorist target because of the training at the military base. To allay their fears, more than 1,000 American troops, along with some Hungarian security forces, have been brought in to keep tight security both around the base and in the villages nearby. For NPR News, I'm Drew Leifheit in Budapest.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 22 points to close at 8,110, and the NASDAQ gained 16 points, or 1.1%. It closed at 1,358. This is NPR News. The Federal Reserve has decided not to change short-term interest rates. As their monthly meeting ended today, the Fed's monetary policymakers said they'd leave the federal funds rate at 1.25%, the lowest it's been in four decades. Social services advocates in Oregon protested today at the state capitol in Salem. They're angered over budget cuts expected now that Oregon voters have turned down a tax hike measure. Colin Fogarty reports from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Measure 28 would have increased the state income tax by $313 million this year, averting spending reductions to social services, schools, and law enforcement. Now that voters rejected the measure, state agencies are preparing to cut medical and home care services to senior citizens and the disabled. One group of protesters disrupted a legislative committee to decry the cuts.
We shall not go quietly. We shall not go quietly.
Oregon Governor Ted Kulongoski says he'll try to soften the blow of the cuts through administrative action. One other result from the tax measure's failure, some inmates in the county jail in Portland are being released early. For NPR News, I'm Colin Fogarty in Salem, Oregon.
AOL Time Warner said today that it's taking a more than $45 billion charge to account for its loss in value. The media conglomerate said that most of the loss came in the final quarter of last year. At the same time, though, AOL's revenues rose 8%. In a separate announcement, AOL announced that Ted Turner is resigning from his post as vice chairman of the company. AOL said Turner wants to spend more time on his philanthropic projects. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the Economic Development Partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy, on the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remarkable portraits of the fetus developing inside the womb have been created by my guest Alexander Tsiaras. His new book, From Conception to Birth, shows human development from the fertilized cell to the birth of the baby. These images show us things we have never seen so vividly before, like the development of the eyes, the vertebrae, the circulatory system, and the brain. Tsiaras creates these images with a combination of technologies. He uses the latest medical imaging techniques, such as MRIs and CAT scans, and he has created computer software that enables him to scan, enlarge, rotate, and enhance the images, leading to more clarity and detail. He's part artist, part journalist, part scientist. An exhibit of his work called From Conception to Birth is now at the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Washington, D.C. One of his photos was on the cover of the November 11th issue of Time magazine headlined Inside the Womb. His images have been used on more than 80 covers of such magazines as Life, Smithsonian, and the New York Times. I asked him to describe what the fetus looks like after just 40 days.
Well, a lot of people think of it as being almost reptilian. I mean, you have this very long, curvy tail, which is really quite wonderful. And you're just starting to see these little beautiful segmentations on the sides of the body that will eventually become the neural endings and, of course, the vertebrae. So that is exactly the same in pretty much all vertebrae, whether it's a chicken or whether it's a pig or a dog. And that you really can't even tell the difference. The vertebrae all start, you know, your ears start on the bottoms of your shoulder and they migrate up. Your eyes start on the side of your head. So there really is no real resemblance to a kind of a little person. You could be look like a little dog, a little chick. They all look pretty much the same.
Including that little human embryos have a tail.
Yes, quite a long tail. It recedes over a period of time, and we always keep that little bit of a tail. It's called a coccyx later. But there's this little tail that sort of recedes as the body sort of starts to migrate down and sort of assume, you know, really basically absorb that entire vertebrae into the upper part of the body.
And what can you see happening after 40 days as the human embryo becomes more human-looking?
It's actually the demarcation point is the eighth week. And that's why we go at the eighth week from calling it a embryo to calling it a fetus. It's all the organs are pretty much in place, the feet and the hands, everything is pretty much defined. And now from 8 weeks all the way up until birth, you're really now just having kind of detailing and elongation. So the real demarcation point here is really 8 weeks.
And at that eight-week point, your book says that the embryo is still only a half inch long, weighing less than a paper clip.
Yeah, it's tiny. It's tiny. That's the extraordinary thing. It's very hard for people to get their sensibilities around the fact that you're looking at such extraordinary detail from this imagery, being able to watch the heart and the lungs and all the organs growing, but it is so small. And this is the kind of extraordinary part of where these technologies have come. That you have these kind of micromagnetic resonance scanners and these kinds of what they call confocal laser scanning microscopes. You have all these kinds of new technologies that allow you to see into these imageries or these tissues that are so tiny. And then you're walking away with this kind of extraordinary detail. And then again, with powerful computers and new softwares, the ability to recompile this is pretty unimaginable when you're trying to conceive it abstractly. But then you look at the pictures and you realize, wow, it's doable.
Before we get more into the technology that enables you to picture the fetus, let's talk a little bit more about the fetal development. What does it look like, as far as you can tell, when the fetus starts to differentiate for gender?
The fascinating thing is that the you start to realize the kind of architecture and design of the beginning of, you know, both male and female. And one of the things you look at, you see the testicles and the ovaries of the male and female look very, very similar at an embryonic period. And then what happens is that the ovaries, which are now instilled with all these eggs, but the male gender has basically the beginnings of what will be the you know, the beginnings of sperm making tubes, starts to descend in the male and then starts to ascend in the female. So these little vas deferens, which are these kinds of cords that connect the testicles to the rest of the reproductive system for the male, are very similar to the fallopian tubes in the female. So at one point you sit there saying, wow, it's just amazing. One goes up, one goes down. And the only thing that defines it is, you know, the X or Y chromosome.
And at what point does the fetus actually start to develop male or female genitals?
They start early on. In essence, of course, the gender is defined immediately. You can start, if you look inside the tissue, you can start to see, you know, at 6 to 8 weeks very clearly the ovaries versus the testicles. It's not until, you know, into the around 11th to the 13th week where you can see it externally. That's why there's a certain period of time where there's a little knob there that we refer to as the indifferent penis, because that could just remain the clitoris or it could become the penis. You can't really tell from the outside.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alexander Tsiaras, and he did the images in the new book, From Conception to Birth. Now, these images aren't exactly photographs. They're like visualizations. I want you to describe a little bit the process of picturing the paperclip-size fetus.
Sure. Yeah, that's been the biggest problem for a lot of people, the concept that they look like photographs because, in essence, they're images. But photography, in essence, photographs or records the surface of an object from one direction. And visualization, or scientific visualization as we refer to it, allows you to scan the tissue from many directions and inside the tissue, so that when you get these sequential slices of the inside and you sort of pack them like slices from a loaf of bread and you put all those slices back together, you have the whole loaf. And of course, inside the loaf, it's extremely complex. Then we use all our mathematical skills to sort of try to figure out what's going on in these tissues. I mean, how does the heart separate itself in value from the lungs? Now we have the ability to actually separate objects from the whole, and we call this segmentation. It's the holy grail of visualization, to be able to pull objects from the whole. In essence, it's the same kind of technology that we use later on for on people who have cancer, trying to separate the cancer from the rest of the body, or whether you're trying to understand the normalcy of our own development, trying to separate where does the kidney begin, when does the liver start to develop, how big does it grow, and we measure those throughout the development process.
So you're 3D. So you're actually taking you're actually getting imaging from lots of almost microscopic parts of the fetus and then reconfiguring it with the help of computers.
Yes. In there's the scanners that we use are very similar to the kind of scanners that you see in normal hospitals, which are in all hospitals, magnetic resonance or CT scans. And we've all seen them sort of on the clipboards of doctors' light boxes. This is just a kind of a research scanner of looking at microscopic tissues, but using very similar types of technologies and very similar energies, except we're looking at very, very small specimens.
So how come, like, when a pregnant woman gets an ultrasound of her baby, it's this kind of ghostly image that you can project, you know, that it's a fetus, but it's a pretty hazy, unclear image. But when you're done, you have this crisp, amazing detail.
Sure. The one of the things is that whenever you're trying to do a lot of scans very, very quickly, one of the issues is that you want to use a low energy that won't hurt the woman, that you can do many of these types of scans and do them on the fly from many different directions. Ultrasound is a spectacular technology for that. And that technology we're relying on more and more into the future. It's getting better and better and better. But if you really want crisp, crisp images, you have to use these kinds of technologies at the moment that give you much higher detail and much higher what they call signal-to-noise ratio and uses a kind of different energy. Those can only be used in research settings. It's extremely time-consuming to set them up. And we're in the infancy of these technologies as well. Mm-hmm. Eventually, these kinds of technologies will overlap with the kinds of technologies that people are using every day.
These visualizations aren't taken from within a pregnant woman's uterus. These come from medical specimens. Where do the fetus medical specimens come from that you've used for your renderings?
Some of them are from within the womb, and others, but the majority of the data is from the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Washington. This was a project that was funded by the National Institute of Health, and basically they have a repository, one of the largest repositories, if not the largest, of embryonic development. And this is really actually derived at the Carnegie Collections, was just celebrating its 100th anniversary.
So these are what, like fetuses in jars, or...?
They're embryos in a collection. Yeah, they're embryos in a collection. Basically, they have all the critical information, and then some of these are put in scanners so that you can actually get a higher fidelity of information from it. And also, you know exactly what you know what you're looking at because you have the external elements of which to match it against.
And how did these fetuses become medical specimens?
This has been part of the collection for many, many years of people who have been dedicated scientists who have been trying to understand the developmental biological process or evolutionary biologists. So having this archive or this repository is absolutely critical. It's not just the embryological collection they have, but they have one of the largest collection of brains and other organs. And this repository is now sort of coming to life again with the ability to scan inside the tissues, whether it's of the brain or whether it's of an embryo. And these repositories are critical for us to not only understand developmental biology or how the brain develops or how any body part, but also of pathologies. So it's an absolute gold mine to people trying to educate others about all processes of life.
Are these fetuses from abortions, from...
Oh, no, no.
Stillborn, or...?
None of them are from abortions. That is very clear. The NIH and the federal guidelines on this are really, really stringent, and we follow the guidelines to the letter of the NIH and the federal laws. And so, basically, these are parts of collections, and I'm not, I don't know the entire history of each specimen because there are so many specimens when we only used a tiny fraction of them. And again, one of the things that we have to specify is that we do not deal with the collection itself. We're of the software side of the development of this process, where you have always in, like, for example, if you think about astronomy, you have people who make the satellites that go out and image the stars, and then you have other people who actually process that imaging. It's the same way in medicine. You have those people who actually go out and image the human body, and then you have other people who interpret it. We're the interpreters. We use our science to interpret their science for them. So we really don't have that much to do with the collection.
My guest is Alexander Tsiaras. His visualizations are collected in his new book, From Conception to Birth. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alexander Tsiaras. He's created visualizations of the fetus developing inside the womb. He uses the latest medical imaging techniques, such as MRIs and CT scans, along with new software technology that he helped create, which enlarges and enhances the images. You're a father. Mm-hmm. When your wife had ultrasound when she was pregnant, how did the look and the meaning of those images compare to the look and meaning of the images that you're doing in your visualization work?
Well, when we went to, we're older parents, so we went in and had amniocentesis, and I use the word we lightly, but when I went in with my wife and she had amniocentesis, of course you have the ultrasound first. And one of the things you're looking through these images, for me it was a kind of a marvel because it's, a lot of times you're looking at specimens that you have no relationship to. And then all of a sudden it's there, it's my son. But what was, I was nearly knocked off my chair because all of a sudden the technician is going down from the head on down and I saw this enormous cyst in the left hemisphere of his brain. I'm like, whoa, wait, what's going on here? And the technician immediately tried to bypass it and say, we'll call the doctor in. And all of a sudden the doctor comes in a hurry. They're not used to having someone really understand what they're looking at. I'm sitting there saying, let's go back up to the head immediately. And all of a sudden, we rushed out, genetic testing and all that. And what happened was that these new technologies, they didn't know whether there was an abnormality. We had the test. There was nothing wrong. But all these new technologies are just coming at us so quickly. We just don't know what they mean. Right now, we don't know what happened to that cyst. Did it just get absorbed? Is that normal? Is that a part of the process that now we're only able to see because we're starting to have these new technologies? So it made me more steadfast about the idea that these technologies are more important in getting more of this information down as quickly as possible so that people really can understand what these things do mean. Does that mean that there is going to be a pathology or is there not going to be, so people can make, really important decisions about the development of their child?
You and your wife must have been so worried from the time after that imaging to the time she actually delivered. You had no idea whether your baby would have a normal brain or not, a functioning brain.
We were terribly frightened because, of course, the physician could not tell you anything. These are all new statistics, new information to them. They just suspected that the cyst would be absorbed. I couldn't understand how. I mean, it was really enormous. I mean, it really took up the entire left hemisphere of his brain. And if he was born and he is absolutely fine and he's 2.5 now and things are great. But we were scared to death, and that's why I was thinking, wow, this imagery, if we could actually just map this, that this is a normalcy, so the next group of people who go through this will understand clearly that this is just, that the baby's going to absorb it over the next 2 or 3 months, and this is just a kind of a tissue process. But that's why these kinds of technologies are important to understand.
Has the visualization work that you're doing of the developing fetus affected your thoughts on abortion?
It's an area that, we try not to go because we try not to politicize this. We try to keep it in the area of science. But I think mm-hmm. I would have to say that it's modified my position. It's like thinking of a photographer who goes to war and then comes back totally unchanged. You would say that there'd be something about their conscience that you'd be a little suspect of. In my case, when you look at this and you marvel at it, all I'll say is that it has indeed affected me, and it has modified my opinion. And basically, that's as far as I'll take that.
No, okay. Are you concerned that these photographs are going to be politicized?
The visualizations, because we're always making that correction. They're not photographs.
They're not photographs, yeah. Right. Thank you. Yes, right. Right.
It's, I was worried about it for a long period of time. I kept on thinking, wow, there's a marvel here that we want to get people to understand. And I think what they're going to try to do is make this into a political football. But then one day I just got up and I thought, wow, what's my problem? That's my job. My job as a scientist and as a journalist is to provide information. And that's what we're doing responsibly. We're providing this kind of extraordinary information for people to make a decision for themselves.
Now, one of the things you've been able to do using this high-tech approach to visualization is to visualize the moment of insemination, the moment when the sperm meets the egg. How did you manage to do that?
Those images, we work with New York University School of Medicine and the in vitro fertilization program. It's wonderful, wonderful stuff to see when you see, just hundreds and hundreds of sperm trying to get in there, and all of a sudden just one goes through and it sort of breaks into the barrier of the membrane of the egg, and then everything else is locked out. So when you think about this in a kind of a natural process, that from the pistol, of the game beginning, 300 to 500 million sperm are taking off, and only one of them will make it in there. And it's a kind of a marvelous process, both the chemistry of what's going on and just the sheer volume, the sheer numbers.
Another amazing project you've done. You had a 1997 book called Body Voyage, a three-dimensional tour of a real human body. Mm-hmm. Now, the actual human body that was used as your specimen for this was a Texas man who was executed, after living on death row, and he wanted to donate his body to science, and mm-hmm. you ended up having access to it. How did you use his body?
Well, that was a project that was funded by the National Library of Medicine at the National Institute of Health. It was the male was about 15 gigabytes of data. The female was about 45. They did her in much higher resolution. What you do is you take the data and you start to look at it and you say, I now have probably from an anatomical perspective, the greatest data set ever created. And now we have to sort of start what we referred to earlier, segmentation, starting to pull objects, separating the pieces from the whole. How is our heart embedded in our chest? How are our lungs, developed around that? And then you sort of just start to pull the pieces apart, and you start to sort of look at them like a jigsaw puzzle. And it's almost like kind of like God's puzzle in a way. I'm going to put these pieces back together. I'm going to put these pieces back together. And I'm going to take a look at all the valves in the heart. And I'm going to show people as to how we're actually taken apart and put back together using this extraordinary data set.
So the body of this executed prisoner who donated his body to science, it was divided into like nearly 2,000 little pieces.
Yes.
So that you could visualize the whole thing in three dimensions, like all the pieces of a puzzle, and put them back together again.
Right. Well, it comes back to that slice metaphor of the bread, except in this case we call him Carpaccio Man, because he's basically 1,878 slices of very thin meat. and so that's, everyone had their name. Some people called him Prosciutto Man, some people called him Carpaccio
Man. who did the actual slicing?
It was a group out of Denver, the University of Colorado, a man named Vic Spitzer created this kind of enormous cryomicrotome, which is basically, it just sliced off 1 millimeter at a time, and then they photographed the image below it and then sliced off 1 millimeter. Also, they did a CT scan and then also MR scans of him. So you had three data sets to compare different kinds of energy. Because every time you use a different form of energy, you get different kinds of readings. That's why when you look at the stars, you may use sound, and then sound will give you back a feedback that's different. Light will give you, and they're all different kinds of frequencies of light. So when you use CT, for example, the denser the object, the more it will absorb the radiation. So that's why whenever you look at an X-ray, the bone is very, very bright because it's the densest object and it takes in a lot of energy. And magnetic resonance is very good on water, so that's why you see so much soft tissue is very, very good. So you had three important data sets that you could cross-reference depending on the strength of the imagery. And this is becoming more and more important now in medicine. They call it multimodal imaging. Modality is the form of energy you use to scan, and multi is meaning using many different kinds. So when you're doing cancer, for example, and you're scanning cancer, if you can use PET, then PET will give you the imaging of where the cancer is, because it glows, because the cancer uses so much more energy than normal tissue. But then the CT will give you the kind of geography of the information. So all these technologies are borrowing. Everyone steals from everyone else. I mean, in essence, we steal from Hollywood, we steal from NASA, they steal from it's a wonderful kind of exchange.
Alexander Tsiaras's visualizations of the developing fetus are collected in the new book From Conception to Birth. These images are also on exhibit at the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Washington, D.C. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of The Crimson Petal and the White, a novel of Victorian England by Michelle Faber. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how documenting death rituals led to his work documenting the development of life inside the womb. We continue our interview with Alexander Tsiaras. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Time of Our Singing by Richard Powers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alexander Tsiaras. His new book, From Conception to Birth, collects his visualizations of the fetus developing inside the womb. These pictures use the latest medical scanning techniques, such as MRIs and CT scans, along with new software technologies that he helped create, which can enlarge and rotate the images and enhance their clarity and detail. One of his pictures was on the cover of the November 11th issue of Time magazine, headlined Inside the Womb. You function as if you had, you know, like Superman's X-ray vision. You see beneath the surface of things, in this case, see beneath the surface of the skin of our bodies. What's your motivation? Why did you want to do this when you started doing it?
Well, I have, you know, a lot of people start in this because they, you know, they're PhD physicists. The others are radiologists. I had a very kind of unusual beginning. I started as a goat herder. When I was 19, I left the United States and I went back. My parents were shepherds in Macedonia, and I wanted to go back and live the life that they had lived. So I spent a year herding 2,000 goats from the Macedonian-Albanian borders down to Mount Olympus. And then I spent a year in my mother's village at the base of Mount Olympus. And I photographed and wrote my first book, which was published by Princeton University Press, on ceremonies, ancient funeral and exhumation ceremonies that date back to almost to Homer. And the Greeks really don't celebrate birth. We only celebrate death. We only have like name days, and everything is based around religious holidays on the deaths of religious figures. And we have an elaborate ceremony in the village that we mourn the dead every morning and every evening for 5 years. And then after 5 years, we exhume the bones. The more flesh on the bones, the more sins the person committed during their lifetime, the less flesh, the less sins. So when the village goes, mostly women, to exhume this body, it's a very, very important moment for the members of that person's immediate family, and they're hoping that there's going to be no flesh. When I saw these women doing these kinds of elaborate ceremonies and then washing the bones in wine and water and wailing and singing these magnificent dirges over them, I was thinking, when I go back to the States, if I could find something that had the kind of power of that imagery and the power of these events. And when I did come back, it was hard. The only places that I actually saw that kind of power were in X-rays. And there was no way that I could really start to collect these files because, you know, as a civilian, you had no reason to be inside a medical archive. So I visited my brother, who's chairman of the Department of Ophthalmology at Brown, and he's an eye surgeon. I thought, wow, maybe if I stay with him for a while, they'll let me into the archives and I'll photograph a report. And, you know, and it was very strange because the thing is that all of a sudden I started to look at this eye surgery and I saw the first cut across the eye, and I thought, wow, this is just like surrealistic art. It's like Dali. And as I started to make these kinds of records, then they did let me into the archives, and I started collecting these X-rays from my personal artwork because I'm principally trained as a painter and a sculptor. And oddly, I started to become fascinated by the science of how the lasers were going across the eye, and that sort of provoked me to learn mathematics and then physics about how this light was going across. And then I started designing my own cameras and lenses. One, I designed a lens that could photograph the development of the egg, one of the first ones in an in vitro fertilization program that became the cover of Life magazine. And then I designed an endoscope that could photograph the development of the fetus from outside the amniotic sac, which again became the cover of Life magazine. So I had this kind of weird hybrid of science, art, and journalism that was going on simultaneously. And about 13 years ago, I decided to sort of transfer that energy to the computer because I saw that these X-rays and these CT scans were making beautiful imagery. So I then learned Unix and then all the computer languages, C and C++, and it was easy to transfer the algorithms of how you made light travel in these endoscopes and these microscopes actually travel through virtual space. And then I started designing these computer codes. So it's a kind of, now we're sort of respected by the scientific community, the journalistic community, the art community, and it all sort of works. Unusually.
I just have to say that listening to you say this, I can think of only one thing, which is how remarkably similar my career trajectory is to what you've just described. Right.
I didn't know you were a goat herder
as well. Yeah. Well, in listening to this amazing description that you've just given, one of the things I want to ask you about, I want to go backwards a little bit, is to when you were in Greece during your goat herding phase, and you were watching people exhume bodies as part of this ancient Greek ritual. I have to say, I mean, the only way I can connect to that, and this is a very kind of gruesome fictional way of connecting, is through you know, body snatcher horror movies. I mean, when I think of a body being exhumed, unless it's for strictly medical or forensic purposes, all I can think of is like Boris Karloff. I mean, certainly it seems like it would be a very unhealthy thing to do, to expose yourself to a decomposing body of 5 years. I mean, it sounds almost unthinkable to me.
Well, what happens in these rural regions is people are, you know, extremely comfortable with death. I mean, when I told my grandmother that in the United States, one of the things, especially in New York City, people do everything they possibly can to avoid death. Like the following day, you know, someone wants to get back to work so they can forget the death of someone close to them, or, you know, try to get over as quickly as possible. My grandmother turned to me and she said, "Varvari, you barbarians." So their perspective on it is that you must pay homage to that. They, in one way, they're extremely comfortable with the process of how it ends. And I must admit, you know, a lot of, to think about it abstractly, it sounds like, you know, the paranoia of your own end of your own existence is indeed frightening. But for them, they were extremely comfortable with it. At least I found that a fascinating part of the process. They also have very elaborate ceremonies in the sense that this ascendance to heaven can be helped. Like people are given dreams all the time. I remember my aunt seeing her father very, very skinny in her dreams, pulling his belt very tightly, and he was totally emaciated, meaning that she then had to give food. So she baked food for the next few days and brought it to his supposed enemies so that that would help alleviate his sins, so that his you know, soul would ascend a little bit more quickly, his flesh would decompose. So it's a lot more elaborate than just basically going and doing the exhumation. Of course, what happens to the bones at the end is that people put them in a box with their photograph on it, and then they can actually bury it under their home, or they can put it in the ossuary. They don't want their enemies to get to it so that they burn the bones.
Who actually does the exhumation and the examination of the bones? Is it the loved ones of the deceased, or are there like designated exhumers in the community?
Oh, they're designated exhumers. That was another fascinating part. These women, most of them, principally it's done by women, and most of them are illiterate, but they were great anatomists. They knew every part of the body, and they knew if there was something there, if someone was trying to hide something, because sometimes their family members will see a piece of clothing or something, and it's almost like a sleight of hand. It wasn't a piece of tissue or something sort of just disappears underneath. But it's a kind of an extraordinary ceremony. That's why one of the things when I was mentioning earlier about coming over to writing these algorithms, one of the first things I did was I wrote a series of algorithms in code to scan my own head, and I did these virtual exhumations as a kind of a new type of portraiture, which was odd that after 2,000 years of doing these kinds of ceremonies this way, the next generation of exhumations was done on a $250,000 supercomputer, but it's all done virtually now.
My guest is Alexander Tsiaras. His images are collected in his new book, From Conception to Birth. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alexander Tsiaras. His visualizations of the fetus developing inside the womb are collected in his book From Conception to Birth. He uses the latest medical imaging techniques, such as MRIs and CT scans, along with new software technology that he helped create, which enlarges and enhances the images. Now, you were trained as an artist, and
yes.
When you were younger, you worked with the sculptor George Siegel, who's famous for his plaster casts of the human body, and there was something really ghost-like about George Siegel's sculptures, because he would plaster cast living people, but then he usually would not paint over the casts. So it would be a perfectly lifelike rendering, but with like a plaster... a white plaster surface, like a shroud of plaster.
Mm-hmm.
You, I think, modeled for some of George Siegel's work?
Yes, I modeled for a number of George's sculptures, and also for Lucas Samaras. They were sort of two of my mentors. And it was great. They were great conversationalists, spectacular teachers, and it was one of the original. I remember one of the things that was so powerful was the idea of how they released you from having to use anything traditional as part of your the materials that you needed to make art. And the power of their ideas, still to this day, stay with me.
Well, it must have been interesting, since you're so involved with anatomy now, but using high-tech imaging, it must have been interesting to have started working with George Siegel, who's also interested in the anatomy, but he's just doing basic plaster casting.
Well, George was much more interested in the kind of the psychodynamic of the social circumstance and what kind of position you would be, sort of the body and the mind would be frozen in at any point in time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the kind of the psychodynamic of being able to see inside. Each one of these is sort of is provoked by different reasons, but you're sort of coming out to the same ends. If you take a look at George, or if you take a look at a kind of a classic movement, something like abstract expressionism, you see that there's a period of time where Jackson Pollock's work is reflective of the time, in the sense that the atomic bomb had just been dropped, but we had just won the war. So you felt this kind of vulnerability, and you felt this extraordinary power, and you could see that all in kind of like Jackson Pollock's canvases. Now, one of the things that I'm fascinated by is that after 9/11, people feel vulnerable, but after the 80s and 90s, in this kind of Generation Y and Generation X of people being totally self-involved, I think that probably one of the next new art movements will be medicine. It'll be where science and medicine, where people can now just go into malls and get scans of themselves. I mean, from a vanity point of view, when you're going and you're looking inside this, there's something about having this kind of ultimate portrait of yourself, but at the same time, it also reveals vulnerabilities. So I think that in another element that's interesting is that probably 10 or 15 years from now, you're going to have these holographic records of yourself, where someone will just touch on the liver, and there'll be this three-dimensional image of the liver, and that will be your patient record. But also, artists will be able to use this information to do a new kind of portraiture. So I think that maybe one of the big next art movements that we may be in the forefront of is the ability to use these kinds of, this medicine meets science, as the next big wave of art.
Hmm. Now, when you work with Lucas Samaras, my memory of Lucas Samaras' work is that one of the things he did was take Polaroids and then a kind of, as the Polaroid was developing, manipulate the image by destroying it a little bit, by maybe moving his fingers across the developing film so that the image was blurred or reshaped in some way. Mm-hmm. How did that contribute to your, if at all, to your sense of what you wanted to do with imaging of the body?
Well, Lucas was pre-Adobe Photoshop. The ability to actually manipulate an image like that was kind of extraordinary. In one way, when I was working with Life magazine very closely, the kind of preservation of the image was absolutely critical, and any kind of manipulation of it was sacrilege, because, in essence, that was the document. And when you then went on to the other side of photography, or photography used as art, the ability that the surface or anything could be done to the image was a tremendous sort of burden off your back, that you really, the idea was more important than the preservation of the document itself. So Lucas was liberating in the sense of the way he actually, manipulated the emulsions of those SX70s, those early Polaroids, and it was absolutely spectacular. Again, from a young artist's point of view, it's getting rid of those shackles is one of the most important things. And that's why, working with these kinds of great artists like George and Lucas was getting rid of shackles. It reminded me sort of a statement that my father said once about saying, I had four brothers, and he said, I want you guys to all go to the best schools, not to find out how good you are, but to find out how bad they are. So the demystification, the getting rid of shackles, whether they're psychodynamic or whether they're just about the material itself, is a kind of important factors in your growth.
I don't know if you're a religious man or not, but seeing how the body is formed in its fetal stages, and then being able to show visualizations of the fully developed body and so on. I mean, the body is a really miraculous thing. Has it made you think more about like a divinely inspired miracle, or are you more into the almost technical aspects of it? I guess I'm wondering if it's changed you at all as in terms of your interest or lack of interest in religion. spirituality, whatever you'd want to call it.
It's hard not to spiritualize a lot of this. A lot of times, most of the time, I'm saying that wonderful line, what I cannot conceive of my own existence, how can I conceive of something greater than myself? That's the way a lot of times I'm looking at this material, and I'm sitting there saying, keep it simple, because it's just so beyond your imagination. But it's hard not to spiritualize it. When I was looking, for example, through a microscope at the cornea, and you look at the body and you say, every part of your body is made of collagen, and collagen is this kind of opaque rope-like substance. And your hair, your skin, your bone, everything is made of collagen, except collagen changes into this matrix form in your cornea. Only there does it change its structure, and because of that, it's transparent. You can see it's so perfectly designed a structure. It's hard not to attribute divinity to it. But then sometimes you just sit there saying that line by Woody Allen says, "I'm a teleological existential atheist. I believe there's intelligence in the universe, with the exception of a few parts of New Jersey." So you run the spectrum when you're looking at this material of total awe of the divinity of it, and then sometimes you just, just beyond you.
Now that you are giving us your high-tech visualizations of what goes on inside the human body, under the skin, or what the fetus looks like when it's developing it, are there certain things that you hope these images will inspire us to think about now that we can see things that we've never seen before?
I think one is that it's the process that we went through again, and I use this word over and over again because it is the most appropriate word. It's the marvel. It's the marvel of our own existence, realizing the complexity of this process and the beauty of it. And the respect of human life when you recognize that the beauty of this machinery that actually does indeed work. I think for us, the marvel and the respect that we walk away from is something that we hope other people from looking at this book. We don't want to make this a kind of a soft sell of the book. We really want people to understand also that this is very, very solid science, in the sense that we're using this as a comparison for the next generation of abnormalities that can help OBGYN and developmental biologists. But if you're just to sit there saying, from a human point of view, it's respect and marvel.
One last question. Remember you told us about the ultrasound that your wife had when she was pregnant that revealed mm-hmm. a large cyst growing in the brain of your baby. What did you do with that ultrasound? Have you kept it?
Yes. Yeah. We have it as we have actually every ultrasound, and basically a kind of a gallery of pictures of him throughout our home. So they're sort of matched up against a lot of the pictures of the from the book. So we're sort of thrilled. Now we see him. He's terrific. He's a wonderful, healthy child. So it's just, we just got lucky.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Alexander Tsiaras's visualizations of the developing fetus are collected in the new book From Conception to Birth. These images are also on exhibit at the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Washington, D.C. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Time of Our Singing, a historical novel about race relations in 20th century America. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Richard Powers is known for tackling intellectually complex subjects in his award-winning novels like The Goldbug Variations and Three Farmers on Their Way to a Dance. In his latest novel, The Time of Our Singing, Powers interweaves physics, classical music, the mystery of time, and the problem of race with real-life events. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that it's a soaring performance that contains a few flat notes.
All novelists play God, but nowhere are their divine delusions so apparent as in historical fiction. What if is the irreverent question historical novels pose? What if the past were to be tinkered with? The big what-if moment in Richard Powers' sprawling novel, The Time of Our Singing, occurs on Easter Day 1939, the day when the great contralto Marian Anderson defiantly sang to an audience of tens of thousands in front of the Lincoln Memorial, after she'd been barred as a black woman from singing in nearby Constitution Hall. What if, on that historic occasion, another young black woman, an aspiring classical singer herself, and a German-Jewish émigré, a physicist who ruminates over the problem of time, were to bump into each other in that crowd, and against all the odds, were to fall in love and marry? And what if they were to have three mixed-race children who came of age in the 1950s and 60s? And what if the oldest child were so gifted as a singer that he, too, dared to cross over the barricades into the lily-white world of classical music? What then? The Time of Our Singing is nothing if not audacious, as it charts the lives of that mythical couple Delia Daly and David Strom and their children. It also retells the 20th century history of race relations in America by revisiting some signature events: the murder of Emmett Till and the travesty of his killer's trial, the March on Washington in 1963, the Birmingham bombing, the L.A. riots, and the Million Man March. Sometimes Powers succeeds in restoring the shock of the new to the past. The set piece on Emmett Till is, in itself, a searing 10-page defense of the value of historical fiction. But other passages where the public and private intersect have a hokey, you-are-there docudrama feel to them. Albert Einstein's visit to the Strom household is one such episode of high fakery that disrupts the spell of belief. Ironically, such flaws actually safeguard The Time of Our Singing against the charge that critics like George Will and Jonathan Yardley have leveled against other historical novels like Don DeLillo's Libra or E.L. Doctorow's The Book of Daniel, namely that these fictions about the Kennedy assassination and the Rosenberg case are so convincing, impressionable readers will swallow them whole as the truth. The Time of Our Singing doesn't pose such a threat because it isn't as powerful, as seamless, as insistent as those novels. It's a moving and very good, but not great book, a second-tier work of historical fiction in the company of other strong second-tier novels, like David Bradley's The Cheneysville Incident or Doctorow's own World's Fair. The main narrator of The Time of Our Singing is the Strom's second son, Joseph, who's born to play second fiddle. Joseph is not as gifted musically as his wunderkind brother, Jonah. Appropriately, he grows up to be Jonah's accompanist. Nor is Joseph as filled with passionate intensity as his much younger sister, Ruth, an irritating Johnny one-note creation who eventually joins the Black Panthers and denounces her classically trained brothers as Uncle Toms. Joseph's account of his and Jonah's musical education is compelling, even to a tin-eared reader like myself. It begins at home, where Delia and David recognize that the world's relentless purifiers would come after their mixed-race children, and that for pure safety, nothing beat music. Jonah, the genius, ends up devoting himself to early medieval music, trying to find the origins of human sound before categories like race make their mark. Music, clearly, is one of Powers' big metaphors here, a formal device for keeping the multitudinousness of his novel from spinning out of control. The other big metaphor is time. And surprisingly, even though it's the more abstract construct, it turns out to be the more affecting one. David Strom, the boy's physicist father, is convinced of the existence of curves in time, loops by which chronology doubles back on itself, and everyone and everything exists concurrently. The novel itself endorses this theory. As Jonah and Joseph age, and sadly come to regret their parents' experiment in mixed marriage, as separatism, not integration, becomes the rallying cry, Powers' novel keeps returning to that utopian moment on Easter 1939, when David and Delia first meet across the color line and think, what if? Though the novel that follows doesn't quite live up to its own ambitions, that recurrent question is poignant enough to carry a reader along.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Time of Our Singing by Richard Powers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song from Chicago. The movie and its soundtrack are hits. Here's a track from the 1975 original Broadway cast recording with Jerry Orbach of Law and Order fame in the role that Richard Gere plays in the movie.
Is everybody here? Is everybody ready? Hit it! I don't care about expensive things. Cashmere coats, diamond rings don't mean a thing. All I care about is love. That's what I'm here for. I don't care for wearing silk cravats. Ruby studs, satin spats don't mean a thing. All I care about is love.
All you care about is love.
Give me two eyes of blue, softly saying, I need you. Let me see her standing there, and honest mister, I'm a millionaire. I don't care for any fine attire Vanderbilt might admire. No, no, not me. All I care about is love.
All he cares about is love.
It may sound odd, but all I care about is love.
That's what he's here for.
Ba 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 boo boo boo. Ba 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 boo boo boo. Honest to God, all I care about is love.
All he cares about is love.
Show me long, long raven hair flowing down about to there. When I see her running free, keep your money, that's enough for me. I don't care.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Unhinged, A Home Repair is Homicide Mystery by Sarah Graves, author of Wreck the Halls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, everything that can go wrong during the making of a movie. We talk with director and former Monty Python member Terry Gilliam. The new film, Lost in La Mancha, documents his failed attempt to complete his movie, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.